Good evening, friends. Now today we have a short talk on the subject faith and knowledge. So what we'll do is we'll have this talk for around 20-25 minutes, try to keep it short, and then we can have discussions on the subject. But before we proceed to the short talk, let's prepare our minds to consider this subject by studying, or rather reading, from the 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 17, Devotion as regards the three kinds of faith. Arjuna says, "What is the state of those men who, while they neglect the precepts of the scriptures, yet worship in faith, O Krishna? Is it of the sattva, the rajas, or the tamas quality?" Krishna says, "The faith of mortals is of three kinds and is born from their own disposition. It is of the quality of truth, sattva, action, rajas, and indifference, tamas. Hear now what those are. The faith of each one, O son of Bharata, proceeds from the sattva quality. The embodied soul being gifted with faith, each man is of the same nature as that ideal on which his faith is fixed. Those who are of the disposition which ariseth from the prevalence of the sattva or good quality worship the gods. Those of the quality of rajas worship the celestial powers, the yakshas and rakshasas. Those men in whom the dark quality of indifference or tamas predominates worship elemental powers and the ghosts of dead men. Those who practice severe mortification, not enjoined in the scriptures, are full of hypocrisy and pride, longing for what is past and desiring more to come. They, full of delusion, torture the powers and faculties which are in the body, and me also, who am in the race of the innermost heart, know that they are of an infernal tendency. Know that food which is pleasant to each one, as also sacrifices, mortifications and almsgiving, are of three kinds. Hear what their divisions are. The food which increases the length of days, vigor and strength, which keeps one free from sickness, of tranquil mind and contented, and which is savory, nourishing, of permanent benefit and congenial to the body, is that which is attractive to those in whom the sattva quality prevaileth. The food which is liked by those of the rajas quality is over bitter, too acid, excessively salt, hot, pungent, dry and burning, and causeth unpleasantness, pain and disease. Whatever food is such as was dressed the day before, that is tasteless or rotting, that is impure, is that which is preferred by those in whom predominates the quality of tamas or indifference. The sacrifice or worship which is directed by scripture and performed by those who expect no reward, but who are convinced that it is necessary to be done, is of the quality of light, of goodness, of sattva. But know that that worship or sacrifice which is performed with a view to its results, and also for an ostentation of piety, belongs to passion, the quality of rajas, O best of Bharata. But that which is not according to the precepts of the holy writ, without distribution of bread, without sacred hymns, without gifts to Brahmins at the conclusion, and without faith, is of the quality of tamas. Honoring the gods, the Brahmins, the teachers and the wise, purity, rectitude, chastity, harmlessness are called mortification of the body. Gentle speech which causes no anxiety, which is truthful and friendly, and diligence in the reading of the scriptures are said to be the austerities of speech. Serenity of mind, mildness of temper, silence, self-restraint, absolute straightforwardness of conduct are called mortifications of the mind. This threefold mortification or austerity, practiced with supreme faith and by those who long not for a reward, is of the sattva quality. But that austerity which is practiced with hypocrisy for the sake of obtaining respect for oneself or for fame or power, and which is uncertain and belonging wholly to this world, is of the quality of rajas. Those austerities which are practiced merely by wounding oneself or from a false judgment or for the hurting of another are of the quality of tamas. Those gifts which are bestowed at the proper time to the proper person and by men who are not desirous of a return are of the sattva quality, good and of the nature of truth. But that gift which is given with the expectation of a return from the beneficiary or with a view to spiritual benefit flowing therefrom or with reluctance is of the rajas quality, bad and partaketh of untruth. Gifts given out of place and season and to unworthy persons without proper attention and scornfully are of the tamas quality, wholly bad and of the nature of darkness. Om Tat Sat, these are said to be the threefold designation of the Supreme Being. By these in the beginning were sanctified the knowers of Brahma, the Vedas and sacrifices. Therefore the sacrifices, the giving of alms and the practicing of austerities are always among those who expound holy writ, being preceded by the word Om. Among those who long for mortality and who do not consider the reward for their actions, the word Tat precedes their rites of sacrifice, their austerity and giving of alms. The word Sat is used for qualities that are true and holy and likewise is applied to laudable actions, O son of Prita. The state of mental sacrifice when actions are at rest is called Sat. Whatever is done without faith, whether it be sacrifice, almsgiving or austerities, is called Asat. That which is devoid of truth and goodness, O son of Prita, and is not of any benefit either in this life or after death. So friends, the topic is faith and knowledge. Faith, the definition, is confidence or trust in a person or thing. It's also defined as belief not based on proof. It comes from the Latin word fidem, fidere, which means to trust. Knowledge is defined as a familiarity, awareness, understanding of someone or something, acquired through experience or education by perceiving, discovering or learning. If we juxtapose these two, at least in the general acceptation of the term, these two seem to be mutually exclusive, contradictory. On the one hand, faith is immediately associated with religion. Knowledge is associated with science. But are these two incompatible? Is something that we should inquire. Also, among these two, which of the one will lead us to truth, the truth about things? Or is it the combination of both? Or is there something else? These are the questions that we have before us. Is there anyone who is entirely devoid of faith in anything? Entirely devoid of the quality of faith impossible to find anyone. Look at ourselves. We have a certain ideal in our life, whether consciously we know of it or it is hidden deeply in our mind. We have a certain ideal in our mind, and that ideal is what we think is good for us. It may be associated with making more money, gathering wealth, career progress and similar things. It may be about finding peace and happiness in family life. It may be about the good of all beings around us, the spiritual progress of all beings, the various such ideals that we keep before us. So we have a faith that that ideal is good. Whatever the definition of good is, we know, we feel that that ideal is good for us, and there are, we come up with various means in our life to achieve that ideal. First of all, there is the belief or trust, a faith that this ideal is achievable, this goodness for myself and whatever that definition of goodness is achievable. If we realize for a moment that that ideal is unachievable, impossible to achieve, then either we cease to exist or we will have to change that ideal. It becomes hopeless otherwise. Take a businessman as another example. He knows that success in this business can be achieved. He has faith in it. He has faith in his ability, and if he employs others, the means that he uses, he has faith in each of these to achieve the certain result that he has in mind. And he knows that by achieving this result, the success in business, is what will bring him happiness or whatever he desires from that business. So here also you see the ideal and the means to achieve that ideal. Philanthropists, they, each one of them have different ideas focusing on different social issues, and they have a certain sense of belief that this is the problem in the world which needs to be addressed, which needs my attention. And then comes what they call as the theory of change. As in, how do I change the circumstances or the causes such that this problem which I am seeing is solved? What do I need to do for that? What are the means which I employ using my organization or through the government or whatever institution? What is it that I do in order to change this? Take another very interesting example. Scientists. We have been taught that there is absolutely no faith which is involved in science. It is all about thorough observation, and only the results of the observation alone is accepted, and that alone will lead to truth. If you look back and see, examine the modern scientific methods, you will find that right during the younger days, during their educational processes, there is an implicit faith attached to the scientific method itself. There is a belief or a trust in the scientific method of inquiry. And the scientific method, the belief is that following this means of acquiring knowledge, we will reach truth or reality. So there is faith actually among scientists also. There is faith in the fact that physical matter is the only thing that there is. Life is an outcome of activities in physical matter. It's implicit faith in these hypotheses or these basic premises which the scientist holds. So, it's impossible to find anybody who is devoid of faith altogether in our general society and world. But what needs to be done is to examine whether faith that we have is closer to truth or is it farther away from it. Is faith based on reason at all or is it blind faith? If the faith is blind, unreasoned, unquestioned, accepted based on somebody's saying or somebody else's authority, then the chances are very high that such a kind of faith is incompatible with knowledge. But what we will see in the course of this talk, next 10-15 minutes or so, is there are actually different kinds of faith, different levels of knowledge. Primarily we can speak of faith as in twofold. One is clearly blind faith, where we see that based on the authority of somebody else, whether it's a religious teacher or it's a book or the popular idea that is accepted in the society, that is taken as truth which is unquestioned. And the power of human mind and the power of man actually is so much that even a blind belief or faith will bring about great results. We find this in the examples of many people who are suffering from diseases which are doctors have given up hope, and they believe in a darga or a particular saint or efficacy of a ritual performed in a temple, and with strong, unshakable faith they do that, unquestioningly they do that. And many cases are there where the cure for the person happens. Very interesting. The studies in the medical science, the studies say placebo effect, or giving dummies instead of actual medicine, 30% of the time it works. As effective as giving the actual medicine. And they see when the placebo effect is studied, they say that the neurological system emits those necessary hormones or whatever is necessary for cure, and the cure happens. So the power of human mind is so much that it brings about these results when a person is absolutely convinced, which means he places implicit faith. What is said is that the greatest power that we can think of is actually human will. And when you have that unshakable faith in something and believe that it is going to cure, it is that human will which works by the lines which has been traced by your desire and brings about that result. Such is the power of faith. But that being said, blind faith in anything or anybody is what is called as an intellectual suicide. It's called as a mental disease. There is another kind of faith. Faith based on knowledge. Faith based on knowledge, which is you are aware of the laws which work, you are aware of the facts in nature, and faith in the sense that it is a logical sequence of things that we know. We know how it works, we do certain things and it brings about results. When we are speaking of knowledge, let us not think that knowledge means only that body of knowledge or that body of observations which the modern science has in its repository. Knowledge has existed all the time. Science has existed all the time. What we see as modern science is is actually a pygmy compared to the great heights which were reached by ancient civilizations. So let us not confuse knowledge to be the only to be the asset of modern science alone. Ancients had reached the very pinnacle, very heights of knowledge. So, without going into the details of this, what can be said is, when we compare the ancient repository of knowledge and wisdom, observation and experience, and compare it with the modern 350-year-old science, we find that the very basic premise of these both body of knowledge are different. So let us not assume that science is the only, the modern scientific method is the only way of approaching knowledge, which the many intuitive scientists of even today have rejected it. One of the person whom we were discussing is Paul Feyerabend. He speaks of epistemological anarchy and says that don't stick to only this means of attaining knowledge, because your ultimate quest is to reach to, which explains, and whatever means which will make you reach that shore of truth should be accepted and not stick to these methods or these techniques alone. So the basic premises of ancient and modern knowledge, ancient science and modern science are entirely different, which is why within the framework of modern science you cannot judge the ancient science, because the framework itself is under question. You need to use a different framework to understand ancient scientific ancient science and its propositions. And this basic premise is most important thing. Take an example. I'll say that out of this building, go straight, at the next circle take left, go 400 meters, you will find Minerva Circle. Now if you start from the right side of the building, then fine, you will reach Minerva Circle. If you start from the left side of the building, you will reach Ashoka Pillar, which is diametrically opposite to Minerva Circle. Just an example to show that doesn't matter how clear your logical steps are, if your basic premise is wrong or invalid, your conclusion also will be invalid, untrue. So if I start from the right side of the building, go straight, next circle take left, 400 meters, right, Minerva Circle. If I start from the other premises, which is starting from the left building, go straight, next circle take left, go 400 meters, it's Ashoka Pillar. Just an example which says that it's not merely the logical steps and the validity of logic, but the basic premises which the body of knowledge holds, which must be examined. Now if taking this example, if we think that senses are our sources of knowledge, we attain knowledge or perception of reality of things or truth through the means of senses. Senses are a channel for knowledge. Then it leads you to one place. And what the ancient science says is, your senses are false, therefore everything that you attain through your physical senses will also be delusional. On the other hand, if you take that there are other faculties in man and other means of knowing truth, apprehending truth, perceiving truth, and there is a means of developing it and follow that discipline, then what the ancient science says is, it will lead you to undecaying knowledge, knowledge which doesn't decay. So, as said in the Gita, that each man is of the same nature as the ideal on which his faith is fixed. If you take your or basic premise as man being an animal, then this is the kind of society we get where animal tendencies in man are encouraged, and the violence and destruction that we see will be the obvious result. If we take the other stand of man being a spiritual being, as all the ancient teachers taught, it leads to an entirely different outcome altogether. This is what Buddha very beautifully explained in his Vipallasa Sutra. He says Vipallasa means distortion, perversion. He says there are three levels of distortion. First is distortion of your view, ditti or drishti, or the perspective. This is distortion of the perspective. From that distortion of the view comes the distortion of thinking, chitta, thinking, which means you have an idea that this is how it is, that man is animal. Then you begin to think like that. From that distortion of the view, the basic premise that you hold, comes the distortion of thinking. You begin to think like that. You begin to feel like that. Leads to the third level of distortion, which is sanna vipallasa, which means distortion of the senses, which means from the idea comes the thinking, from the thinking comes acting. We begin to act like that. So this big premise that we hold, this ditti or drishti, the view that we hold, is of most important. Here let us recollect what ancient said about the various grades of knowledge. There is one level of knowledge which is called opinion. This opinion stage is the lowest stage, wherein this opinion is based on merely perception, sense perception. Whatever I see, feel, hear, touch, smell, taste, that only is real. Everything else beyond that, I don't see, I don't perceive, therefore it is not real. Plane of opinion. Then there is a plane of science, the next step. Science actually is, you can call it, twofold. If the science tends towards merely sense perception, examination of the senses, and such things, then it tends downwards, it doesn't lead towards truth. But on the other hand, if the science turns upward and take the universal basic principles which all the great sages of all religions speak of, take that as the basis, those basic premises, then it leads to the next step, which is dialectic. Dialectic, that is examination or inference or logic based on universal principles, universally valid principles. Take geometry for example, it proceeds from the plane of universals to particulars, in the sense Euclid's book, The Elements. It comes up with various propositions which you have to accept. There is no proof that can be given, it is self-evident. The first proposition, for example, says that two things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. Now, what proof can you give to that? It is evident, self-evident. Similarly, another example, in the fifth proposition, he says the whole is always greater than the parts. Can you give any proof to that? It's self-evident, right? Similarly, in the science of life, there are certain self-evident principles. Reasoning based on that self-evident principles leads us to truth. So that is the third step, dialectic, the step of dialectic. Finally, it leads to the plane of illumination, where there is no question of faith at all. It's direct perception of reality or truth. And those who have reached this step say that when you see, when you perceive this reality, you see that all beings are but aspects of one. This separateness that we see is because we work on the plane of opinion or on the plane of lower science. But when we educate ourselves through these other two steps of knowledge, we find that all beings are but expressions of the same single life. The external differences that we have, caste, color, religion, sect and so on, are shadows, illusions. A very beautiful story to illustrate this. Plato speaks of it in the Republic. He gives this allegory, which is a story with a hidden meaning. He says of this particular cave. In the cave, people are chained at the end of the cave, such that they are facing the wall of the cave. Their legs and neck are chained such that they cannot move around, turn back. That is their position. Behind them, there is an elevated place, on that there is a wall. Between that wall and a fire which is there much behind, people pass on, carrying things on their head, and then talking to each other, laughing and smiling and crying and so on. You know, the people who are chained in that cave, looking at the wall, will see only the shadows of the people walking behind them. They cannot turn back and see what is real. So the echoes that they hear of the people talking at the other end of the tunnel, of the cave, the echoes that they hear, they think that the shadows are making those sounds. They think that the shadows are real. And then they begin to have this game of guessing things and then playing this game of shadows. But outside the cave, there is the real world. Assuming a person unchains himself, because he hears the voice of others saying that you people are chained, there is a different world outside. What you are seeing are but merely shadows. Then he, with great struggle, he unchains himself and his muscles are all atrophied. He needs to turn back with great effort and then climb over the wall. And then can he see the fire which is burning behind him? He cannot, because his eyes are tuned to the darkness and the shadows on the wall. He needs to acclimatize himself to seeing the fire first. And then with great effort climb out of the cave. Can he see the sun? His eyes will burn. So he needs to go in the darkness first, in the moonlight, see the reflections in the water, acclimatize himself to the real world, understand how the real world is, and then finally go on to the real, the sunlight, right? This is a story that Plato gives, which actually speaks of the evolution of the soul, the condition of the soul and the evolution of the soul. The general condition of all of us is, of the persons who are chained at the end of the cave and looking at shadows, hearing echoes, and thinking that the echo is the real sound and the shadows are making those echoes. This is the plane of opinion, which is faith based on tamas or darkness. Then you begin to hear, because there are others who have unchained themselves, gone out, seen the world, they have come back. And they say that this is not the real world. And we all laugh at them. What nonsense are they speaking? And Plato says, if we were to unchain ourselves, we would even go and kill them for talking foolish things. That's the condition of the world. So we unchain ourselves, go and acclimatize ourselves to the fire, the brightness of the fire, the people who are walking there, the objects that they are holding. This is the plane of science. Then we walk out into the night and acclimatize ourselves to the real world outside the cave. great world outside, beautiful things. That is the plane of dialectic. And finally, when we go into the sun and see the reality as it is the plane of illumination. There is no faith at all. So there is a tamasic faith, because we are in the darkness looking at shadows. Then there is a sattvic faith when we are acclimatizing ourselves to the fire. Then the sattvic, where we see the world but still in the moonlight. And then is the illumination, which is not faith at all, which is beyond faith, because it's direct apprehension of truth. This is the journey of knowledge that one has to, each one of us have to undertake. So let's stop here and we can take up any questions.